Welcome to another program of Savoir Faire, the program about design and designers, which is being brought to you by the History of Art Department under the coordination of Dr. Giuseppe Scambri Bonacci, who is also the Artistic Director of the Indina Biennale 2015. I am Melanie Farrugia and I will be your hostess during this program. I remind you that the program comes with a website where you can view images of what is being mentioned during the program. The website is melfarrugia.wix.com/savoirfaire. Also, I urge you to like us on Facebook by searching Savoir Faire and also to like the Campus FM Facebook page, which you can find under Campus FM 103.7. Welcome to Program 15 in the series of Savoir Faire. Today with me I have a special guest, Francesca Balzan, and we shall continue discovering more about jewelry. Last week we discovered some exceptional pieces of jewelry, thanks to Francesca. All the featured pieces were exhibited in the exhibition Vanity, Profanity and Worship, Jewelry from the Maltese Islands, organized by Fondazione Patrimonio and curated by the same Francesca Balzan. For those of you who missed the programs, I remind you that these are available as podcasts at MaltaUniversityBroadcasting.com and choose webcasts and then select Savoir Faire. You can also follow images of what we are discussing during the programs by accessing the following website, melfarrugia.wix.com/savoirfaire. And I remind you that for more images and information about the jewelry that we have been mentioning during these programs, there is also the catalogue of the mentioned exhibition and also the DVD. Today we will be mentioning some information about how jewelry features as amulets, and then we will be discovering more about the post-war and contemporary jewelers and jewelry, and the connection with the Maltese Islands, and we will be concluding with an exclusive interview with jewelry designer Francesca Grima. So, Francesca, let's start by discovering how jewelry features as amulets and as objects against superstition.
Yes, that is really a fascinating part of jewelry history. It's probably the one thing that really got me hooked. With amulets, we've got a very strong history, of course. We're in the Mediterranean, and beliefs and superstitions run rife, and they still do to this very day, but more so in the past. I mentioned the Mediterranean Sea, which produces a number of things for us which we can use in jewelry. Let's look at coral, for example. Coral was actually brought up from our waters, and coral is a precious object, beautiful red coral, and it has always, at least since Roman times, been connected with protection against evil, later on in Christian times, protection against the harmful effects of the devil. And in fact, through the centuries, we've seen coral being used in different objects, worn on the body, even in paintings, in Renaissance paintings, for example, not in Malta, but in Italy, you'll see pieces of coral hung from the Christ child's neck. This was not so much as protection for the Christ child, who didn't need protection, of course, but it was a prefiguration of the blood he would shed on the cross. So it takes on all these different shades of meaning. Other objects, for example, the Lingue di San Paolo, the so-called Lingue di San Paolo, which are nothing but fossilized shark's teeth. Really interesting. We find them in great abundance in our rocks. They have been deposited millions of years ago, most probably. But because of their shape, the shape of a shark's tooth vaguely resembles the shape of a tongue. And therefore the connection was made with Saint Paul. Saint Paul's tongue converted the Maltese to Christianity. So there was this wonderful syncretization of beliefs, of sort of this superstition about these fossilized teeth being able to protect you, and at the same time the connection with Christianity. It made them even more efficacious in their protection, of course, once you draw in Christianity as well, and the protection of Saint Paul. And it has been found, actually, this subject has been researched extremely well and in depth by Dr. George Zamit Mempel, and he's published a number of studies about it. And what was found was that a number of these Lingue di San Paolo were exported to different places in Europe, And not only were they exported, obviously, for sale, but they actually produced handbills, which were the equivalent, I suppose, of our flyers nowadays, extolling the virtues, explaining how they should be worn, like on bracelets or around the neck, and what they would do. They would protect you against poison, they would help to cure you, and these wonderful stories. So, this is really, when you look at it, you can say that this is Malta's greatest contribution to the international jewelry scene. And you do see, for example, even Flemish paintings of the 16th century, where, for example, in a goldsmith's shop, you'll see a Lingua di San Paolo hung on a shelf behind the goldsmith, because it was going to be used, probably mounted in jewelry, to be worn, as explained in the handbills, most probably. So yes, this is really an interesting aspect. But also things like bezoar stones. These bezoar stones are stones that are not minerals. They're actually accretions that occur in the body of an animal, or either in the brain or in the stomach. And the most efficacious of them, or they perceived efficacious, was that found in the stomach of a bezoar goat. So that's why they're called bezoar stones. And these, again, were said to protect you against all sorts of maladies. In Malta, we don't have a strong use of them, I suspect, because we had our readily available Lingua di San Paolo, which more or less covered the same instances of protection. But, for example, in 1747, when there was an exchange of gifts made by Grandmaster Pinto to the emissary of the Pope, when the Pope's emissary came to present him with the stock and pillar, gifts were given by Pinto, and amongst these very, very precious gifts, he gives the Pope's emissary items of a superstitious nature. He gives him serpent's eyes, which are as well fossils. He gives him Lingua di San Paolo and bezoar stones. So despite the religious nature of the order and all that, they still believed in this sort of superstition.
A year and a half ago, or 2 years ago, I was in Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
And they have this eye-shaped amulet, mm-hmm. Which is believed to protect against the evil eye.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I was at a tour and the coach stopped us at an opener market, and all these women were giving me these and actually pinning them on my t-shirt. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. When I left, I had like five of these evil eye things.
It's strange, but you mentioned the eye, but the eye is something which comes to us from several centuries back. Of course, we always think of the eye on our Lutzo, on our very colorful boat. But the eye, the snake, the symbol of the snake, these are all very potent symbols that have passed down through several centuries. So we're talking well before the Knights period, well before the early modern period. And yet they continue through the centuries. There's almost an unbroken tradition. They're taken up by subsequent cultures, taken up by subsequent religions, and embraced and believed in as well. Another example, if you like, is the horn, the shape of a horn. That's something that you see if you walk through the streets of Naples, you still see a lot. Sometimes you find them in red plastic rather than coral. Originally they were made of coral. There's a wonderful painting of a little child, Francesca Sciara, in the Casa Rocca Piccola collection, and she's wearing one of these horns. And again, that is to protect her against evil. Even just depicting a child, you're almost courting danger, so you ensure that this child is bedecked in coral or in some sort of symbol to turn away the evil eye and any possible curses. Another very potent symbol, which comes from way back, even from Roman times, is the higa, that's in Spanish, the mano a fica, which is actually a very vulgar gesture made with the hands, with the fingers of the hand. It's considered vulgar, especially nowadays. However, it was considered a gesture which could turn away any evil that was trying to attack you. And you find little pendants made of these, made in this shape. You find them even in churches. You find them on rosary beads, because people would just really take no chances. You have a rosary beads to pray on, but at the same time, they would hang these horns, they would hang the higa, they would hang all these objects, literally taking no chances.
Francesca, I would like to ask you if old jewelry can still be worn nowadays.
Yeah, why not? I think you can't wear it in profusion because you look like, you know, a great grandmother or something. But absolutely, I mean, jewelry was made to be worn. Of course, one has to take precautions if you're wearing pieces of filigree which are encrusted with seatbelts, something that was very typical of the 19th century. If you're wearing them, to be careful not to wear them on sort of a fluffy woolly sweater because it'll obviously pull the pearls. So these sort of precautions. I think you can even reinvent their use. For example, why not wear a earring as a pendant? If you tie it properly, it can be done. And it's a new way of wearing objects. Rosaries can be worn as necklaces. There are some very beautiful rosaries. And there was a time, even in the past, when, and I've seen in portraits, when rosaries were worn as necklaces very easily. It won't damage them in any way, but you're in a way proposing a new unusual use for a piece of jewelry.
And is there any other context where jewelry from the past is being used today?
Yes, I mean, recently, for example, perhaps about 2 years ago, we had a real big cameo moment. Now, with cameos, especially shell cameos, they became very, very popular in the 19th century, but they had a tradition which was rooted really far back. I mean, in the Renaissance, there were some absolutely wonderful intaglios and cameos. Then through the years, they got forgotten. Then there was this great revival in the 19th century. Everybody was wearing shell cameos. Even, they're not actually all that expensive, so they were worn even by the merchant class and perhaps a slightly lower down the social order. And then they were, you know, in recent times, we used to look at them and think of them as sort of the sort of thing our grandmother would wear, so there's no way we would want to wear them. You know, these big brooches, which are made of, they're carved out of shells. And usually they have either sort of a classical figures, a Bacchus head or a maenad or this sort of thing on them. But about 3 years ago, there was this great revival once again. And you'd see them even sewn onto dresses or as pieces of jewelry. So necklaces, earrings, brooches. Not so much, I mean, brooches are not really popular at the moment, but they were the occasional ones as well. I saw them both in jewelers, so they were considered as precious, especially if mounted in gold or silver. But I saw them as well in plastic versions, emulating these shell cameos and being sold by the really popular high street brands, which are international. So this whole trend really took off internationally. And it's great because when you look at what is really fashionable on the street at the moment, in terms of jewellery, many, many times you can link it to the past. It's clear that jewellery designers are very inspired by jewellery history. There's somehow always some connection that you can make with either Renaissance or 17th or 18th century jewellery. Of course, in most cases, because people are not too into jewellery history, they don't make these connections. But the truth is that in a way, we're not inventing so many new ideas, but we are plundering the past to rehash these ideas and come out with very contemporary designs. Jewelry has also been taken out of context in a very interesting way. For example, a friend of mine whose work I admire greatly, Brian Gregg, a photographer, a local photographer, has taken on this idea of, he's basically taking up old jewelry, images of old jewelry, and reworking them into composite images based on Baroque and other images, but in completely new arrangements, which I find really, really exciting because he's tapping into our past and yet proposing completely new imagery for our contemporary times. So this is where it's exciting to see how jewelry, in a way, its use as well as being subverted, but in a positive way. So it's used as design, it's used just for appearance, not necessarily relating to its original context or original meaning, and yet its design and its appearance and its aesthetics are still being appreciated, and they're still relevant for the contemporary artist, which is exciting.
It surely is. Thank you, Francesca Balzan, for all the interesting information. And now we shall move on to discover more about the jewelry designers Andrew Grima and his daughter Francesca Grima. course, in a program about post-war and contemporary jewelry designers, one has to obviously mention Andrew Grima, whose hallmarks are the textured yellow gold, abstract non-representational shapes, and unusual colored precious materials. Who was Andrew Grima? I shall be mentioning some abstracts from an essay featured in the exhibition catalogue that I've been mentioning. The essay is called Andrew Grima, an outstanding international jeweler of Maltese descent, by Amanda Troisi. And also I will be mentioning some more information from articles from various websites about Andrew Grima. Andrew Grima was one of the most outstanding jewelry designers of the 20th century. His unusual style radically changed the direction that jewelry design was taking in the last century, and his influence was widespread and enduring. He was born in Rome in 1921 and moved to London at the age of 5. His father was a Maltese embroidery designer and his mother was Italian. He received brief training as an engineer before he joined the British Army, and his start as a jewelry designer was quite a serendipitous event. The father of his first wife, Helen Haller, owned a small jewelry workshop where Andrew Grima supervised its accounts. I'm gonna read an abstract about this event from TheGuardian.com. Because Grima handled the firm's money, he was called in when, in 1948, two dealer brothers arrived at our office with a suitcase of large Brazilian stones. Aquamarines, citrines, tourmalines and rough amethysts in quantities I had never seen before. I persuaded my father-in-law to buy the entire collection and I set to work designing. This was the beginning of my career. What Grima did with these precious stones was very radical. His creations are rough and raw. At times he started with sketches and drawings and even direct casts from nature, like sticks and leaves from the countryside, and cast them in gold. He continued experimenting for a number of years until a great opportunity came along, when Andrew Grima was asked to produce pieces based on wax models commissioned from sculptors Kenneth Armitage, Elizabeth Frink and Bernard Meadows for an exhibition of modern jewelry organized in 1961 by the Worshipful Company of Goldsmiths. Picasso and Alexander Calder also loaned works for this exhibition. Grima did also 6 jewels which were included in the exhibition, for which he won a De Beers Prize. This was the stepping stone for Grima, who was noticed by the curator of the exhibition, Graham Hughes, who subsequently introduced him to potential clients and also through connections that Grima managed to do himself. To cut the story short, in a matter of a short time, his patrons included even Prince Philip, who in 1966 bought a brooch made of recycled carved rubies for the Queen. Grima received numerous awards, including 12 De Beers Design Diamond International Awards, and also in 1970 he received the Royal Warranty from Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II. In 1969 he was commissioned a collection of watches from Omega. The collection is called About Time, and consists of a number of one-off Omega watches. The faces of these watches are covered in gemstones instead of glass, which to a certain degree obscured the hands and dials, conveying a mysterious quality to the piece, which is no longer just a reminder of time. The dials have no numerals, which prevented the wearer to obsess on exact and precise time. And now let's mention something about his shops, which also reflect his original style. Grima's shop in Jermyn Street in London brought a radical modernity to the serious and sober St. James's area when it was launched in the mid-60s. It was designed by his two architect brothers, with a shop front conceived by sculptor Brian Neal, which featured rough and irregular slate slabs, secured by bolts and nuts, and randomly punctured to reveal rectangular showcases. The steel door was designed by Geoffrey Clark. Two floors were linked by a spiral perspex staircase. The circular room in the basement was referred to as the round room and often served as exhibition space. An array of shops followed in New York, Sydney, Tokyo and Zurich. Grima died in 2007, leaving his business in the hands of his second wife Jojo and their daughter Francesca Grima. Francesca Grima joined the family business at 18 and spent 10 years working alongside her father, continuing the brand's tradition of creating glamorous and unusual one-off jewels. In 2014, she founded her own jewelry line, creating playful contemporary pieces. I'm very pleased to tell you that Savoir Faire managed to get an exclusive interview with Francesca Grima. And now we will listen to some of the abstracts from this interview. Thank you, Francesca, for joining us and for the opportunity to have this interview. Let's start with the first question. Francesca, what does jewelry mean to you?
Well, apart from the fact I spend every waking hour of the day thinking about jewellery, what does it mean to me? Well, firstly, I like the fact that unlike clothing, fine jewellery rarely, if ever, goes out of fashion. I like that versatility, the fact you can wear a vintage piece with a new outfit. I also like that there's always a story behind a piece of jewellery, the occasion it was purchased, the loved one who gave it to you, the person who wore it before you, the fact that it can be passed down the generations, I love that. And from a personal perspective, most of the pieces we have in stock, either my mother or I can remember when it was designed, the goldsmith who made it and the customer who bought it. Many of our customers have become lifelong friends, so it's a highly personal business. There aren't many companies around today that know the names of every one of their customers.
How does jewelry complement an outfit? Or if perhaps you consider that the jewelry should be the most important thing in an outfit?
I don't think jewelry is always the most important part of an outfit. Like any accessory, it can be either casual accent or make a statement. My father's jewelry was very bold and glamorous, but you can still wear a Grima brooch with a tweed jacket or a pair of golden diamond earrings with jeans and a sweater without looking over the top. My own pieces are also quite bold in design, but at the same time I envisaged a younger, more casual customer who would be able to wear my things with any outfit any day of the week.
At 11 years old, you were already considered as an up-and-coming designer. What do you consider were the most important and precious things you learned from your father?
The most important things I learned from my father were, firstly, never to try to follow current trends. I mean, I think you can take inspiration from nature, culture, whatever. It's always better to try and create a new trend than follow an existing one. And the second lesson he taught me was never to compromise a design just to make it easier or cheaper to make. He believed that if you make your own jewelry, there's always a temptation to make life easier for yourself. And the third thing he taught me was about quality, that jewelry should look as good from the back as it does from the front. You know, so many times I pick up a nice-looking piece of modern jewelry only to turn it round and find that it's been badly made. For example, you know, the stones set with ugly claws and no back holes in the settings. I find that even famous luxury brands cut corners by making pieces in the Far East and just finish them off in Europe. That's not the Grima way, which is why we can only make 20 to 30 pieces a year, and why we'll always be a small family business.
Francesca, your father designed a series of watches for Omega. Are you interested in designing watches or perhaps more original pieces of jewelry, which are also timepieces?
Well, I would love to design a watch collection one day, but for now it's not a current priority for the Francesca Grima brand, as we've only been trading for just over a year, and so it's slightly too early, I think, to think about watches. At Grima this year, we're making a very limited number of our iconic teak watch, and following that, we may think about designing a new model, which would be great fun. We'd keep the classic Grima elements of textured gold and seeing time through a stone, but it would be amazing to create something for a new era that stands the test of time.
Let's talk about your last collection. What influenced you in this collection?
Well, my last collection is also my first collection, actually. It's based on pixelated squares, which are reminiscent of the graphics from the first PCs and arcade games in the 1970s. A square or cube, I find, is very versatile and a great building block and can be used to create a range of simple or complex forms. It also gives the jewelry some posture and structure, which I think is a reaction to the current trend for, you know, over-elaborate, fussy-looking jewelry, which doesn't really appeal to me.
Francesca, this collection shows more precision in the finishing of the pieces compared to your father's style.
Yes, in fact, although I designed the collection on graph paper, the pieces then had to be converted into CAD. It would be impossible for a goldsmith to hand make the clean, geometric, engineered look I was actually aiming for.
As a contemporary jewelry designer, what do you think of the Maltese filigree, which can be considered as a symbol of Maltese traditional jewelry?
Yeah, it reminds me of the filigree designs my father's family used in the manufacture of fine linen at the turn of the century. They used to import the cloth from Ireland, and they employed hundreds of women who worked from them to hand-stitch these filigree designs in Italy. It was a big business at the time, but unfortunately ended abruptly just before the Second World War, when Italy invaded Abyssinia and Britain imposed a trade embargo. I think the silversmiths who make the filigree in Malta are real craftsmen. It clearly takes a huge amount of skill to create such complex designs. Personally, I like to see the technique adapted, you know, to more contemporary designs. As someone with strong family ties to Malta, I'd love to get to know the goldsmith and silversmith community there, and perhaps one day, you know, to work in a collaborative way with one or two of them.
Thank you so much, Francesca Grima, for this exclusive interview, and we do hope to see you in Malta sometime soon. I hope you enjoyed today's program, and I urge you to join us next week for our last program about jewelry, where we will be discussing filigree and discovering more about contemporary jewelry designing in Malta. I thank again our special guests today, Francesca Balzan and Francesca Grima, and I remind you that you can download podcasts of all these programs from the website MaltaUniversityBroadcasting.com by choosing the webcasts tab, and from there you can choose Savoir Faire. I hope you enjoyed the program today, and I urge you to join us next week. This program was brought to you by the History of Art Department under the coordination of Dr. Giuseppe Scempri Bonacci, who is also the Artistic Director of the Mdina Biennale 2015. For more information about the Biennale, you can visit mdinabiennale.org and also join the Facebook page, which you can find at the Mdina Cathedral Contemporary Art Biennale 2015. I am Eleni Farrugia, and I hope you join us next week for another program of Savoir Faire.